side. We're going to see if Carrie can use the microphone or not.
Yeah, I'm hoping I can project without worrying about how close I am to this. So can everyone hear? It's okay. If you can't, if I begin to fade, just okay.
I can't hear. That's just, yeah.
Let's do it this way. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, we have this is an old book. This book is 50 years old, and I had heard, in fact, 50 years old a week from, a week ago today, it was 50 years old, the publication. The book itself is much older than that, and I have several things that I want to show you. This book is, unlike most novels, an artifact, a kind of iconic artifact in its own right. And you probably, I love this slide because Kerouac is almost obliterated by the manuscript itself. And what you see here is, in fact, a part of the manuscript. I have some slides that I'll show you in a minute of the whole thing. It's been on tour. It's like a rock star. Rolling Stone wrote about it. Kerouac touches us in some really interesting ways. And the book itself will probably never grow old until America runs out of gas. That's probably literally true. Kerouac's dates were 1922. He was born, died in 1969. He did not have a retirement strategy, and he turns out he didn't need one. But this book is a repudiation of every bourgeois preoccupation, and I think that's why we love it. Those of us who are bourgeois loathe the middle class conservatism and the carefulness and the planning and all this, and we long to burst out of this, and we can if we read Kerouac. Kerouac promises us really interesting things. I want to make a distinction here before we begin between the person who narrates the novel and the character who actually experiences the events. This is something that first person, we have Keith Scribner in the audience, a novelist, who would probably agree that all writers are control freaks. They want to get you into the situation that they control, and one of the great seductions of literature is the first person narrative, because it seems to be spontaneous, it seems to be personal. We all tell first person narratives, our friends tell first person narratives to us, and we're seduced by them, because it seems that there's no intermediary between experience and telling. But of course there is, as anybody knows who's carefully planned. My favorite example is a narrative of outrage. Someone has done you wrong, and you tell your friends about it, and you don't quite get the reaction you wanted. And so you think, what's wrong with this narrative? I'm not getting the response. So you replan the narrative, and you excise certain things and emphasize certain things until you get it right. You get the look what they did to me kind of narrative. And in many ways, On the Road, although it celebrates, it's a novel of victimization of the character that we call Jack Kerouac, although there's some confusion there too. So Kerouac had the misfortune of becoming famous. Joyce Carol Oates, about 12 years ago, wrote an article in the New Yorker, and it began with the line, "Those whom the gods wish to destroy, first they make famous." And so Kerouac got up in the morning of September 5th, 1957, and he opened the New York Times, and this is what he read. "On the Road is the second novel by Jack Kerouac, and its publication is a historic occasion, insofar as the exposure of an authentic work of art is of any great moment in any age in which the attention is fragmented and the sensibilities are blunted by the hype of fashion." Does that sound familiar? "Just as, more than any other novel of the 20s, The Sun Also Rises came to be regarded as the testament of the lost generation, so it seems certain that On the Road will become known as that of the beat generation." Now, the interesting thing is, Gilbert Milstein, who wrote this review, was himself a young and not the regular reviewer. A reviewer named Orville Prescott was the regular reviewer, notoriously conservative. He was on vacation. The New York Times would never even have reviewed the book, probably, had Prescott had anything to say about it. And so there was this moment, this moment which began the hype and made Kerouac famous. He was famous only very briefly. For example, almost immediately the reaction set in when the regular reviewers in other publications, Norman Podhoretz, for example, Diana Trilling, the speakers for the elite in New York, came down really hard on the novel almost immediately. And Kerouac had a contract for $110,000 for movie rights, which was withdrawn as soon as it became clear that this was a dangerous book. All support disappeared, and Kerouac was really angry. Marlon Brando asked him to write a three-act play in which he, Brando, would play, you can guess, Dean Moriarty, the wild bunch going solo. So Kerouac, for a moment, had all this promise, and it faded very quickly. One of Kerouac is conning you, as I say. He's a series of contradictions. He says here, this is only half the page, I'll show you the other half later, but he says here, this is jazz talk. Kerouac loved jazz. He actually thought of the jazz composers in America of his time were equivalent to Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. He really thought these were great artists that, of course, people didn't understand, and maybe they still don't. So he wants spontaneity. He gives you a first-person narrative that he pretends is spontaneous. And he starts a myth that it is spontaneous. The myth looks like this. This is the scroll itself, which, as I say, is if a library has a room 120 feet long, it can accommodate this show. The myth is, as it says here, about Kerouac, is that he wrote On the Road in April 1951 in a three-week frenzy fueled by Benzedrine and coffee. When I mention Benzedrine to my students, they don't know what I'm talking about. I guess Benzedrine is a generational issue, so I have to translate it into something else, speed or reds or uppers or whatever often I don't know what they're talking about. But this is the myth, and Kerouac actually encouraged this myth. Now, the lovely thing about this myth is the spontaneity looks like this. This is at the show, and they unroll the scroll. You literally could go into the library and read the novel by moving down the table. This is actually 10 pieces of paper, 12 feet long, scotch taped together, that he rolled into the typewriter, making a unified, organic, spontaneous experience, according to the myth. Okay. The beautiful thing about this is, this is a 170,000-word paragraph. There are no paragraph breaks. In other words, Edgar Allan Poe said in the middle of the 19th century, when he was trying to get a formula for writing, he said, the most you can demand of a reader is an hour and a half. After that, in fact, Poe didn't like the novel because he said the novel's a big baggy thing and people put them down, life intrudes, the spell is broken. And you come back to it, and you're a different person, or the power of the artist to seduce you is lost, and it has to be picked up again. And since the artist cannot predict when you're going to put it down and when you're going to pick it up, the artist becomes less influential in your mood. So this is a novel you can't put down. If you put it down, you've stopped in the middle of a paragraph. And I find it's a wonderful metaphor for a continuous reading. But of course, he wants you to believe that he actually constructed it this way. In truth, and this does not degrade Kerouac at all. He started in 1948. The notebooks make clear that he had a plan. He had references to the great artists that he admired, T.S. Eliot, the high modernists, and a list of themes. He was working the way F. Scott Fitzgerald worked, with an outline, a kind of preconceived notion. He actually began in 1948, which means when he went on the road in 1949, he already had a matrix in his mind for what he was looking for what he wanted. So many of the experiences, for example, that he says simply happened serendipitously, happened because, in fact, he needed a certain kind of experience. And he needed it to fill a matrix that he already had in his mind. He didn't like the novel. He published one conventional novel in 1950, and he really didn't like it. It wasn't what he wanted, because the novel is a kind of social thing, and his novel, his first novel, is a kind of social thing. It deals with social experience. This novel is something else. And if I can go back for a second here, think of the Torah. Think of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Think of every time in contemporary movies somebody opens a scroll. That very act tells you that what is in this document is super significant. It might even be a stupid pirate map, you know, for Pirates of the Caribbean. But nevertheless, it's something very special that comes on a scroll. This is again part of the myth that he wants to plug into. There's somebody actually reading it. His other influence is the generation that came before him. When Milstein talked about the Hemingway novel, he I don't know if he knew that Malcolm Cowley, who was an editor at Viking, was the one who in fact was responsible for getting this novel published. Malcolm Cowley had written a book called Exile's Return, which appeared first in the 1930s, and which was his narrative of his days in Europe with the expatriates. And he imposes a narrative and gives meaning to the characters and their relationships and made a lot of them angry. In 1951, he revised Exile's Return. That same time, Kerouac's manuscript appeared. And what Cowley, who is now getting to be an older guy, saw in it was a direct connection with the halcyon days of his youth and the revolution of the expatriates after World War I. So this is after World War II. As you may know, Kerouac joined first the Merchant Marine, then he joined the Navy. And he was discharged from the Navy in 1943 when he announced that he was sorry, he couldn't kill anybody, even in self-defense. So in other words, after he was in the Navy, he basically announced that he was a conscientious objector. And they discharged him, not dishonorably, but they said he had psychological issues. So Kerouac, from the beginning, had this instinct. He had a double instinct. He really was a double creature, full of contradictions. He was a great admirer of William F. Buckley. And one wonderful moment was appearing on Buckley's firing line in 1968, during, as you probably remember, the crisis of the Democratic National Convention, anti-war protests reaching a peak. He wanted to renounce all this because there were two, as I recall, there were two major thinkers that the young people in those days were quoting. One was Ralph Waldo Emerson. If you go to Emerson, you can find a quotation to justify just about everything from right-wing politics to anarchy. And the other was Kerouac, and Kerouac wanted to say that no, he had known Buckley back in the days when he was a Columbia football player and Buckley was at Yale, enamored of the British monarchy. And he was a great admirer of Buckley's conservative politics. So he wanted to renounce his sainthood. He said, I'm apolitical. He says, I'm a Zen person. And so what he wants is in fact experience. Well, as Flannery O'Connor pointed out, a novelist has to create a world. By necessity, there has to be a world where people live, eat, sleep, drive, feud, whatever. But as O'Connor said, that's not the purpose of the novel. The purpose of the novel is to use this so that you can see something else, and that's what Kerouac is about. So what scandalizes America about this novel was, of necessity, his rebellion against middle class Moors. The other influence is Whitman. Remember Whitman, if you've read Song of Myself, you know that Whitman comes at you with his arms open wide. And he says that you and he are great pals, and that you can put down your defenses. He says at the beginning, "What I assume, you shall assume." Just think about that one for a moment. It's kind of coercive. And Whitman gives you the same kind of spontaneity, the same kind of apparent lack of art and artifice. He wants you to put your guard down, but he's not. He's conning you because he wants to set you free, and that's what Kerouac is doing in this book. So had Whitman had a typewriter, I can imagine that he might well have rolled a long scroll into it and typed the poems of Song of Myself. He didn't, but. This is the state of the novel now. This is just off the web. If you have $8,000 and you want a pristine first edition in the original dust jacket, you can have it. Isn't that something? $1,000. This is Kerouac began to be photographed. He's an amazing guy. On an MSN website last week, Carolyn Cassidy said, when she was asked about Kerouac, probably because of the 50th anniversary, what she remembered, she said, "I remember him as a hunk, as a football player, and as a klutz." That he was a guy who just barged around into things, and if you've read the novel, you know that he fails over and over and over again, especially sexually, because the Cassidy character is this sexual athlete who's just running back and forth from woman to woman, and there are times when he literally tests the Sal Paradise character, who always fails. He gets dumped. He can't perform. You know, all the rest. But he has a wonderful face, and he was much, much photographed. Marc Chagall, in the brief period between the Milstein Review and the heavy hitters, wanted to paint his portrait and imagined his portrait as having angels flying around his head. Well, Chagall was a very spiritual painter and saw, I think he saw immediately what Kerouac was about, what he was interested in. Robert Frank, a photographer, wanted him to write an introduction to a book of photographs called The Americans. As I say, Brando also knocked on the door. And so they had him pose. This is a kind of religious pose. I love the plaid shirt. He actually does have connections with the Northwest, as you may know. He served a summer in what is now the North Cascades National Park. On a fire lookout, and wrote a novel about it, which defies all the rules of the novel. There are no other characters besides the... Mm-hmm. But then Dostoevsky did that. Okay, and then this is from England. I love this. For Get Your Kicks for 3 and 6. What the bourgeoisie is interested in this novel is its escape from the strictures of... What Freud and Civilization is Discontent said is the prison we put ourselves in by necessity, because if we all got out, it would be a madhouse and the world would be an unlivable place. A student did this, and when you click on the website for other links, they've disappeared, and so I don't know who this student was, but very enterprisingly mapped all 4 trips. There were actually many trips, short trips. These were the main ones. What I like about this is visually it's a mess. And what was wrong with the manuscript, as far as Malcolm Cowley was concerned, was it was a mess. He said it simply swung back and forth like a pendulum from east to west. It didn't have a structure. It wasn't a novel. And Cowley gave him lectures on it. He says a novel is a group of people, and they meet, they interact, and they change each other. No, not necessarily. But again, Cowley was thinking about the bottom line. He was thinking about profitability. And the book had already been rejected by Viking, and so he thought he was doing Kerouac a great favor by continuing to lobby for it. But this is what it looks like. It's just all over the place. So what happened is this. Cowley did not send Kerouac galley proofs. Kerouac never saw galley proofs. When the novel appeared, he was furious. He said, "Shame on American business. They put in a million commas. A comma interrupts, yes?" He says, "To hell with commas. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go." So this is what the manuscript kind of looked like. It was that one continuous free flow. And he simply told it the way it happened. He tried to obliterate all the thematic material. But I'll go back to Cowley, who... in his Exile's Return, says this. He's trying to explain the expatriate generation. Life in this country has become joyless, colorless, universally standardized, tawdry, uncreative. It is the duty, of course, of every American generation to say this. our children and grandchildren are saying it now. And what I find really interesting is, I don't know how many of you have high school-age children or college-age children, but the road trip has now become a kind of standard feature of senior year in high school. That I asked my students about this, and so many of them have done this, and a road trip means that in the spring break week, you go from, say, Corvallis to Albuquerque and back. The point is to be on the road. It's not to go someplace. It's to be moving. Putting tons of carbon into the atmosphere, you know, this sort of thing. But that's who we are. And so Kerouac's idea is that you must exile yourself. And this is a very, very old theory connected to art. What we call a picaresque novel is a novel that has no structure. And many people would say, Hemingway, in fact, said that American literature begins with a novel called Huckleberry Finn, which is called picaresque because Huck, of course, is a picaro, which is Spanish for rogue. It means he's paid a price. He's detached and powerless, and that makes him a good witness. He has nothing to. We have nothing he wants. We have no way to make him behave, so he will tell us what he sees, and that's the pose Kerouac wants. At the same time, Kerouac also needs money, and the real Kerouac was back in New York trying to hustle. He was furious. He tried to persuade the Hollywood studio to film the movie in this way. He said, you can do it cheaply. Just put a camera on the car that shows the dashboard and the windshield, and put Sal or Dean's feet up on the dashboard and just let it roll. And whatever happens, happens. Well, you can imagine how Hollywood saw that. But this is it, the idea that we must, as Americans, certainly, we have the most mobility and the most space, we're envied in the world for this, you have to get away. If you want to find truth, you have to get away. Gallup poll doesn't give you a truth. You must find it yourself. And think of the Old Testament prophets going off into the desert. This is, again, a very old thing in our civilization. But it's what he tried. Now, I often give my students this photograph and ask them, to tell me about these two men. Which one is dangerous? Kerouac is the one on the right, and Neil is the, as one of my students said, the dark, dirty one. He's dangerous. He's the one you do not want your daughter to meet. Now, this is the one I love. This is the Oregon slide. This is the bus, Kesey's bus. And Kesey was the third generation. Kesey was very smart. He saw that the Beats in the late 40s and 50s had kind of established a revolution after a war. And he very self-consciously made a tour of America, picking up people, making connections. They're on the way to New York and then Massachusetts. To get Kerouac, and that's Cassidy, Dean Moriarty, driving the bus, and he was totally taken by this because, as he put it, they were filming it. It attracted a lot of attention. There were so many girls, and when they picked up Kerouac, he said, "Isn't this great? It's just like when we were on the road." And this is what Kerouac did. There was a couch with an American flag as a couch cover. And he went over and he removed the flag from the couch and folded it into military style, into the triangle, and set it on the back and then sat down on the couch. He was totally, totally offended by a lot of what these people were doing. So there he is. And the guy, he just looks like a crazy man, doesn't he? I mean, there's something really wonderful. You'd like to spend a weekend with him, but he would also probably destroy your life if you spent more than a weekend with him. So this is 64. This is a joke, but you know you've made it in America if you appear on a stamp. Well, you have to die first, but so you won't know, but this is it, and this is a joke. This is Neil Cassidy, and of course the Grateful Dead loved Neil Cassidy because he was the crazy guy. This will be echoed in a minute. Later, Kerouac actually was featured on a stamp as a major American writer, which would have, I think, pleased him, but he'd have seen the irony. Kerouac as a as a commodity. He is a commodity now. And if you go on the web, you find an amazing number of different kinds of manifestations of Kerouac. All you have to do is buy this t-shirt. It has the typewriter on it. That's all you need. You don't need Kerouac's name or anything else. It's just the typewriter. It's beautiful. It's the machine that was turned into the servant of spontaneity. It's the greatest typewriter in history. This old manual. And this is a photo, a t-shirt. Yap. He's used to sell khakis. He didn't get royalties for this, obviously. Now, earlier I gave you the quotation. The quotation is from a real estate firm. In Denver, there is a subdivision called the Kerouac Lofts. Lifestyle with a beat. This is obscene. This is obscene. Part of Kerouac would have just flipped to see that he's being used in this way. They even give you these 65% reserved. In other words, get there fast, or you won't be living in the Kerouac lofts. But there's a theory that says in the late era of American capitalism, there will be no revolutions because we buy our revolutionaries so fast. Our rap artists make one album and they're multimillionaires, and there's probably nothing that makes you think twice besides being a multimillionaire hoping for another contract. So this is too much. And there's the stamp. There's the stamp. 29 cents. It was some time ago. But what I'd like to do is to very briefly maybe go through four or five things that explain why this novel has this hold on us. And they're all ironic. Kerouac stood for nothing. He finally agreed with Gary Snyder that he said the wisest thing he ever heard was when the Buddha said that any organized expression was a denial of Zen. That you can't, in other words, have an orthodoxy. You can't have a church. You can't have believers. You can't have, this is a kind of antinomianism that says you don't need a preacher. It's in you. You find it, you don't find it. It's almost an accident when it happens. You must pursue it, and you may do terrible things to people in pursuing it. The climax of the novel is, of course, the betrayal of Sal by Dean, and he has to do it because he has to. He has to pursue his demons, and so Kerouac's connection here are four or five. One is the theory of the golden land. As I said before, America is envied all over the world because we have space. Space explains us. And if we want to escape, we can escape. Deborah mentioned that I taught at a university in Macedonia, which in those days was one of the seven Yugoslav republics. And the students were studying, but there was a 50% unemployment rate. They couldn't leave. They couldn't even go into another republic. They wouldn't be welcome. Their accent would give them away. They were stuck. They could go to Australia or America, the two great dream places, the two places with space. But ours is much more hospitable. He says about L.A. in the book, he goes to Denver, remember, and then there's somebody promises him a job, and he goes to San Francisco. He works as a guard. You can imagine, talk about the wrong career. But what he does is he reenacts American culture's movement across the continent. We get to the Pacific Ocean, and where do we go? We have to turn back on ourselves. And it's at that point, he thinks, up to that point in the novel, that he is living a linear plot. Linear means you keep going. And he gets to California, and he realizes, I can't. And then he tells you in the narrative, I decided I would make my trip circular. I would go to Texas, where he had some friends. And so he makes a circle, but it's as if he doesn't realize that's actually going to happen. He's so naive that he thinks he can just keep moving forever. One writer called this it's the great American fantasy. In Europe, we have a Faust legend that says if you sell your soul to the devil, you know you're going to have to pay. In America, we have the illusion that you can sell your soul from the devil, and then when the devil comes to collect, you're gone. This is what Huck Finn does at the end of his novel. When he's learned how evil everybody is, and he pretends not to know, and he says, Tom and I are lighting out for the territories. There's always that false hope that we have space and we can escape, that we don't have to be there for the accounting. And so this is one of the things that Kerouac actually opposes. At the end of the novel, he finds out that, remember he called Dean earlier on a new weird kind of American saint. He uses religious imagery all the time. He says, in fact, there was when he was 15 or 16, he turned off all the lights. He'd go to girls in the room, and then he'd just talk. He would talk to them. And the force of his voice, as the narrator says, would make them come across. He could seduce them, in other words, in the dark with just his voice. And then he said, now his disciples, he calls them disciples, were married. And now that he says, now they're angry at him, they're turning on him because of the very spontaneous, presumably, sex life that he had opened to them. And now they were angry because, of course, they'd become married and bourgeois. So he's this horrible, he's this saint, but he's also a strange influence. He doesn't bring people happiness, and we usually think of saints as bringing people happiness. That's not the case here. And in the end, of course, he is a saint who becomes Judas, and betrays at the end of the novel. He betrays Sal, leaves him sick because he says, "Hey, I've got to go to New York. I just got a divorce. I got to go get my next woman." And so he takes off. One thing I like, Oregonians always appreciate this, he calls L.A., which is, he says, the L.A. is the result of people arriving at the coast and then realizing they can't go any farther. So what do they do? He says, L.A. is the whole mad thing, the ragged promised land, the fantastic end of America, the one and only golden town. California, he said, is empty-headed. Now, that sounds really negative, but... And I remember thinking about this. James Salter wrote a book called Solo Faces, which is about technical climbing. It's a really good book. But there's a guy in the East who has never been to California, and he wants to go to California to rock climb. And he says to a friend, "Well, what's it like?" And his friend says, "There are no ideas there, but you might see God." So that's exactly what he's talking about here. That ideas, in fact, are stupid. What are ideas? What you want is a kind of enlightenment that has no words, and that's what he's about. The second thing, of course, is the religious quest, and that's that salvation by exile. Those of us who were around in the 50s remember that beatnik was, of course, has the suffix at the end. All of this happens in the Cold War, the McCarthy era, the Red Scare, and so beatnik was the implication that the beat generation was actually communist, or equivalent to communism, trying to undermine America, trying to destroy America. And Kerouac, he says that the word beat came to him as a religious moment, that he was praying before a statue of Virgin Mary, and that he thought of beat, and he thought of beatific, which is the same word, but a new suffix. So it's really clever to take the word beat and add ific, and you get a spiritual realm, and you add beatnik, and you get the Kerouac thought that literature is the voice of intuition, which is not far from madness. And so that's really what he's doing. You can't hold him accountable. You can't say, well, if everyone behaved like this, the world wouldn't go very well. He would say, well, everybody doesn't behave like that, but the world might be happier if they did. Jazz, of course. What I like is I find this book a comic novel. And many people do not, because there's an association that if you allow comedy to enter, you make it superficial. And I think of the comedy as absolutely implicit, that most of the things that happen to Sal that matter happen accidentally. The things he plans don't go very well. If in other words, you plan, you're never going to get anywhere but that which you had imagined beforehand, whereas by accidents, he ends up humiliated, yes, that's not so good, but the things he learns that are most important happen because He is a Picard, he's an outcast, he's a fool, he's a victim, all those things he finds only because. Now, finally, I hate even to mention this, freedom and gender. Many people object to this book because women are treated abysmally. They are abandoned over and over and over again. Wives are simply abandoned. They're left in Albuquerque or wherever, and so maybe they pick them up later, but maybe not. And so, again, I think of literature is not an equal opportunity employer. Okay. In other words, a work of literature has a job to do. And think of Cinderella. Cinderella is not a novel, not a story about weak fathers. There has to be a weak father, or you can't have a story. In fact, he's irrelevant. The story is about what happens to a young woman when she realizes that her father is not the answer to her life's questions, and she has to find somebody else. That's basically what that story is about. So if you make a sociological analysis of it, it looks like it's attacking fathers. Doesn't. This novel makes some women look, well, I'll give you three examples. There's a sullen blonde he meets in Cheyenne, Wyoming at this phony cowboy days fair where you know, real estate dealers and all these other guys are walking around in cowboy boots that obviously pinch their feet and they don't wear them. And he says he spends a lot of money on her, hoping obviously to seduce her, and it doesn't work out. But he spent like half his money in this one night. He didn't have much. But he says, I had broken up the purity of my entire trip. So now this is the old thing, you know, Odysseus lands on an island and there's a woman named Circe who turns men into pigs. Yes? That's her job in the novel, to lure men away from their true path. And those who are lured away are destroyed. So he's lucky. He gets out of there in time. Terry in California, the Hispanic woman who he meets on the bus, and she's married, she has children, and she says to him, I looked at you and I thought, there's a nice college boy. I can't believe that I'm going to get a nice college boy. So you can't say she's an innocent victim here, you know? She's actually social climbing to some extent. And it's a wonderful comic. He thinks that she has a pimp outside who's going to beat him up or kill him or something. And she thinks he's worse. And they have this, and then that starts their relationship, which is really quite pure and sweet until he has to leave because her husband's looking for him. And then finally, Sal and Dean's discussion. I'll read you a very brief quote. I find this comic because by this point, halfway through the narrative, I think Kerouac knows that you're beginning to ask questions about how are women being treated here. So he has the following discussion. He says, "My aunt once said that the world would never find peace until men fell at their women's feet and asked for forgiveness." But Dean knew this. He'd mentioned it many times. Quote, "I've pleaded and pleaded with Mary Lou," his wife, "for a peaceful and sweet understanding of pure love between us forever, with all hassles thrown out. She understands. Her mind is bent on something else. She's after me. She won't understand how much I love her. She's knitting my doom." "The truth of the matter is, we don't understand our women. We blame on them and it's all our fault," I said. "But it isn't as simple as that," warned Dean. "Peace will come suddenly. We won't understand it when it does. See, man?" Doggedly, bleakly, he pushed the car through New Jersey. At dawn, I drove into Patterson, and he slept in the back. There is finally no answer, but at the end, when Dean betrays him in Mexico, Dean says, "He's sorry, man, you know, but I've really got to go." It goes like this. He says, When I got better, I realized what a rat he was. But then I had to understand the whole impossible complexity of his life. How he had to leave me there, sick, to get on with his wives and woes." Yeah, so, in other words, there's something invisible in this novel that the wild character, the one that everybody wanted Kerouac to be, they wanted him to be the wild one. And he says, "No, I was Sal." That people kept thinking, no. If you made up Dean, you must be Dean somewhere. And he said, no, that wasn't it. But this guy isn't happy. And this chapter ends, actually, in effect, the novel ends, the rest is just summary. He says, okay, old bean, I'll say nothing, which I find a wonderful irony. It's like you do somebody wrong, and he says, I won't tell, but he tells you I won't tell by printing it in the novel. It is a con job. It's very manipulative. It seduces us into remembering what we want to remember. And I remember a remark about The Red Badge Occurs that when we read it, it reads us. And so if you ask people, what do you remember about this novel? What they tell you is who they are. We can't remember all of it. I think we tend to remember those parts that are part of the mythology we want, you know? And it's a beautiful book. And it seems to me, as long as we have a middle class in America and cars, this novel will be great. And the new edition, by the way, the one just out, is the scroll version, the original version with all the stuff in it that they took out because it was possibly too explicit and wouldn't sell. So if you want to make your way through there looking for this, there'll be an industry now in the next 10 years of scholars pouring through line by line to see what the changes were. This is a national historical park in Lowell, Massachusetts, where Kerouac grew up. French-Canadian immigrant family. And this is from his journals. I love this. This was the young guy. I promise I shall never give up and that I'll die yelling and laughing and that until then I'll rush around this world that I insist is holy and pull on everybody's lapel and make them confess to me all. This. Think how many images there are here. He's both the wild man and the priest to whom we confess. And that contradiction, I think, is a really nice way to remember Kerouac. He really wanted it all. He did not want to be stuck in any socially defined function whatsoever. And the book, I think, does that. So it's good for that reason. Thank you. Yes?
Do you think that Kerouac was ever able to completely shape his upbringing and his religious background from the time he was a guy.
Yeah, I don't. I'm told that he really was, in religious terms, a mystic. I mean, he wrote letters to God, to Jesus, the church itself as a hierarchy meant nothing to him. But he really was a mystic, and I think he never got rid of that. But everybody demanded that he be a guru of social answers to social problems, and that was totally confusing for him. I mean, it's like, think of any American philosophy. I think of Emerson, and Whitman came right out of Emerson. Whitman was the functioning artist out of Emerson's philosophy. Emerson's philosophy is a mess. You can't get a social program out of that, and you can't with Kerouac either. He's, I think of Martin Luther, who was a mystic, the 95 Theses, that's quantified, but that's not who he was. And I think Kerouac is probably a similar type. He was really, really many characters inside that self. Is anybody here just a really has read all of Kerouac and knows the whole thing? He wrote 30 books, and his great plan was to write. He wrote 8 novels, all of which. All of which are the story of his, it's called The Legend of Duluoz, which is his alter ego, his French-Canadian alter ego, that he's trying to do, again, what Whitman did, is to encompass everything with these autobiographical narratives that he said are unmediated. They're the truth of what happened to me. And they go from the North Cascades to Paris. Satori in Paris was the second to the last book he published. Looking for the Zen moment. That's somewhere in him, that's what really motivated him. Kept him writing. On the other hand, he had to sell books, so he squabbled with publishers and editors. But that's, to me, not the real Kerouac. Anyway, an American icon. Keith?
So how's the experience different reading the new edition of the scroll?
Actually, I have not. I was told that they were actually going to sell a scroll. In fact, the other version just came out, and I get it because I was told, no, the scroll is coming, and it hasn't come yet. I would like to read the scroll. I really would. Although the ending is not there, and the story is a dog chewed it up. There were also three scrolls. He did it once, and then he did it again, and then he did it again. So I don't want to spoil it, but the scroll is not a scroll. There were several spontaneous scrolls created. So. Yes.
How would you evaluate this book beside Wounds of Great Crucial?
Sometimes a great notion is I think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as the mad book that Kesey did, and I'm more shaky on Sometimes a Great Notion because my memory of it is of the family, the Western Oregon, the tragedy in paradise sort of thing, and so I think of that as Kesey more under control than the other one, but they're both certainly. Kesey longed to be the wild man that he saw, or that he thought he saw in Kerouac, and I don't know about Kesey's spirituality. He doesn't seem very spiritual to me, and I don't. I think what he wanted was the revolution. He didn't. He wasn't so much interested in Zen. Yeah. But that may be because that's what he has to present, and I'm not. Getting through that, and I'm not sure. I'm shaky on that. Yes.
When they were on the road together, they took so many ideas from Cassidy. How true is that?
Who knows? Probably so. I mean, he says that.